All right, all you movie junkies, it is time for the SLS Cast with your hosts, Matt and Tim. And welcome to the SLS Cast episode 10.
Oh, number
or
10.
Perhaps episode X? Dun, dun, dun.
Oh, I'm sorry. I missed the cue. I apologize. Should we do that again?
No, that's okay. I'm going to let your awkwardness stand, and we shall carry on. How you been doing, sir?
I've been doing all right, thank you. And yourself? I'm just sitting here with my hot beverage, just relaxing, taking it easy.
Beverage, yes. I have my handy-dandy glass of water, and, sounding a little rough around the edges here. My daughter has decided to attempt to get me sick. I have this weird thing where I am immune to my wife. I am immune to my eldest two children, really. Back when I was married to my first wife, my son never got me sick. And now with my daughter, eldest daughter, she can't get me sick. But apparently my youngest daughter can. And so if she comes down with a runny nose, I could be within a 5-mile radius, and it's like my own little contagion movie.
Yeah, it's starting. It's spreading.
Yeah. So that's where it's at for me. Other than that, though, life's going. Life's going. What about you, sir?
Yeah, doing the same. Well, not getting sick part. After seeing the movie Contagion, I'm kind of being a little bit more cautious, I suppose, of what I touch and don't touch and how I go about, interacting with folk.
Outstanding. I'll make sure to stink palm you the next time I see you.
You totally should. Please fart in my face. I love it.
Oh, awesome. All right, well, shall we go ahead and jump right in with the news then?
I think we shall.
Then let us shall.
We shall, as we scamper upon into the news. I'm just going to flat out tell you that I only found really one piece of movie news to me that was actually worth mentioning.
All right, and go for it.
Kevin Costner news, since we were last week, we were talking about Kevin Costner and Dances with Wolves and all that fun Kevin Costner stuff. Kevin Costner was supposed to be the villain in Django Unchained, and if you guys have been... Yeah, I mean, him as a villain, has he really ever played a villain at all? I mean, I'm going through his list of films.
Yes, he was the bad guy in the movie with the where he's pretending to not be a Russian spy when he is a Russian spy. No Way Out.
Well, for the movie Django Unchained, it's a Western that Quentin Tarantino is making. It's supposed to be awesome, and Jamie Foxx is in it, and shame on me for forgetting his name. He won the Supporting Actor Academy Award for Inglourious Basterds. Oh, Christoph Waltz, that's his name. He's in it as well. And honestly, Kevin Costner, he's been in a lot of Westerns. What's one he did with Robert Duvall not too long ago? Open Range, back in 2003. He was in Tombstone. Even Dances with Wolves could even be considered kind of a Western, Western themes, I guess.
It's actually often credited with reviving the Western genre.
Oh, yeah.
I thought it was Unforgiven, personally. But sure, if people want to go with Dances with Wolves, I suppose I'm good with that, too.
Yeah, he also did Silverado, and one of his first movies, Fandango, which is, if anybody has not seen Fandango, you must see it. Terrific road movie. Please see it. It's great. He would have been terrific as. I guess he would have played the plantation owner, who is
No. He was the Leonardo DiCaprio, I think, is supposed to be the plantation. I think he was the supposed to be kind of like the boss of the slave gang.
Okay.
Or the slave, or the, whatever.
The whipper.
Yeah, basically the guy with the whip.
Yeah. Yeah, so so who knows? I mean, they have to find somebody to pull it off. And I was like, okay, well, who are some people that kind of look like Kevin Costner? Kiefer Sutherland? Maybe? Probably not. Kirk Douglas, even. After seeing Kirk Douglas as the bad guy in Quentin Tarantino's Grindhouse segment, Death Proof, man, he would be an awesome...
You mean Kurt Russell?
Yeah. Who did I say? Kirk Douglas?
Yeah. You said Kirk Douglas. I'm like...
Oh, no. Sorry.
Why? What movie did you see him in that he was a bad guy then?
Oh, sorry. I meant Kurt Russell. My bad. I got the K's wrong and the last names mixed up. He has a better looking wife anyway. But yeah, I mean, even Kevin Bacon, I can see him as this bad guy. So, but yeah, that's. I'm just going to leave it at that. If anybody has any idea of who would be a good filler, who would outbeat Kevin Costner in that role, just send us an email or even comment. Show it to the other 1,400 folk that...
That's a news item. We recently discovered that we have now passed not just 1,000, but over 1,400 people have listened to our show now. I think that's great. I'm happy with that.
Yeah, that's savvy with me. That's fine.
Excellent. And while we're feeling love... I think we can segue into my first of two news items. That Lion King also felt the love over the weekend.
Did you just seriously pull the Elton John and Tim Rice thing on us?
I did. Twice, actually. Okay, so yes, Lion King, actually. It's 1994 all over again, according to the Associated Press. The Lion King was re-released in 3D this time. And, you know... So now we get to hear my favorite line in all of cinema. Not really, but you get the idea. Mufasa. Ooh, say it again. Mufasa. I love that. Those hyenas crack me up. Whoopi Goldberg and Cheech Marin. Hell yeah.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, they're the two hyenas, or one of the... Or two,
yeah,
the
there's
three
two of the three, because Ed doesn't really talk. He just kind of... Anyways. But, yes, with $29.3 million over the weekend, and, of course, that's using the 3D gimmick, so people are paying extra.
But that's still... That's a lot.
Yeah.
Even when Toy Story was re-released, and even Nightmare Before Christmas re-released, it, you know... Came
this is true. This is true. I mean, the original film, though, back in 94, made $40 million when it opened nationwide. So it actually, granted, with inflation, taking out 3D and inflation, I don't know how it did, but still, $29 million this time around versus $40 million its first time around. It's not bad.
Yeah, I remember seeing it in the movie theater the first time.
I did see it in the movie theater. And you know, again, I do have kids, obviously. I've talked about them before. But I like Disney movies anyway. I grew up with Disney movies, and I like Disney movies. And I totally wanted to go and see Lion King. And that is probably, in my opinion, of all the Disney movies, that is the best opening to any Disney movie that I've ever seen, any Disney animated movie that I've ever seen. I can't think of anything that opens better than The Lion King. I just love the whole circle of life thing and the majestic panoramic views and all the animals coming out. And then Rafiki takes Simba and lifts him up. And then the beam hits, the sunbeam hits and opens up Pride Rock. And then they zoom out all the way really fast. And, you know, and it's the circle of life. And then all of a sudden, and then it just goes black and it says The Lion King. And dude, I love that.
Yeah, it's pretty spectacular.
And say anything you want about the rest of the movie, whether you like it or not, or what you might like about it. For me, hands down, best opening. Whenever the girls put The Lion King in, I will actually sit and watch just so I can see the first 3 minutes.
Yeah, and the movie, and the crazy thing is that I can't really watch the movie past the opening, because to me, it's as depressing and emotionally involving as Bambi or Dumbo, even. Bambi and Dumbo scarred me as a child, and this movie did too.
Weird. Okay.
Well, no, I'm talking about Simba's father dying.
Yeah, I mean, it was kind of very Star Wars-ish for me, so I kind of dug that aspect of it.
I was 5 at the time. 6-ish.
So old. Yeah. Because I was like 16? Yeah. What's up now?
And you went to a Disney movie.
Hell yeah. I'm telling you, I love those movies. And you know what got me to see that movie in the theater?
What's
The trailer is just the opening 3 minutes of the movie.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And I saw that trailer, and I was like, holy crap, this looks ridiculously amazing. And I went and saw it because of that.
See, I've been there, too, because that was the time of Disney's second golden age. You know, because you had that, you had Aladdin, mm-hmm. Little Mermaid.
Little Mermaid was actually... Little Mermaid gets the... as a side note or whatever in the Disney lore, Little Mermaid gets the credit for the Disney Renaissance. But it was actually Rescuers Down Under that was the kickoff of the Disney Renaissance.
That was early 80s, though. Oh, Rescuers Down Under, you're not talking about... That's right. Okay, yeah, I see what you mean.
And I saw that one in the theater. And I liked it, but...
Great freaking animation, though. Like, whenever the eagle's flying to the canyon and...
Oh, yeah.
Crap, the beginning? Jeez.
So, yeah, I just really liked the original Rescuers. Yeah. But yeah, so Rescuers Down Under is actually the one that really triggered it, though Little Mermaid typically gets the credit for it.
Yeah. And I think Little Mermaid was also the next movie Walt Disney himself really wanted to make before he passed away, if I remember correctly.
I have no idea. They were buying, I mean, he was buying rights to movies 10 and 20 years before they were getting made.
Yeah.
So
entirely
possible.
Good for him, because they're all terrific. Well, most of them are terrific.
Exactly. Okay, so... last bit of news for me then is, as we all may remember, Dennis Hopper passed away a little while ago, and he actually has a son named Henry, and he is coming out in his first movie called Restless. And let me see if this plot sounds slightly familiar.
All right.
It's, and again, this here is, hat tip to Movie Talk, and Jonathan Crow. It says, quote, in Restless, Hopper plays Enoch, a troubled youth who has a penchant for dressing like a member of the Addams family, and who, after the sudden tragic death of his parents, feels compelled to crash other people's funerals. He meets Annabelle, a vivacious, Darwin-obsessed lass who, as it happens, is dying of cancer. While hanging out at the morgue and drawing chalk lines around each other, they fall in love with the bittersweet knowledge that their romance will be short.
Is she middle-aged by any chance? Or
no, she is young. I was like, I started looking her up. She's played by Mia Wasikowska.
From that 70s girl chick? Or wait, hang on. Mia Wasikowska. Or was she Alice in Alice in Wonderland? Is that true? Yeah, that's it. Mia Wasikowska. You're right. Well, it's directed by Gus Van Sant, so that should be... But then again, Gus Van Sant did direct the remake/ripoff of Psycho in 1998.
True, but this one actually looks to be a semi-original plot instead of a terrible remake. Yeah. So we'll see. But at any rate, I just was like, wow, is this Harold and Maude? Is this supposed to be a remake of Harold and Maude? But at any rate, so it does seem kind of interesting. I just thought that, you know, we'll see if, you know, the pressure's on to see if he's got the acting chops of his dad or his mother, because his mother was actress Catherine Lanasa.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah.
We'll see how it goes. I just thought that was a pretty interesting news item. So, how about 3 Squared, Tim? Are you ready for 3 Squared?
I am ready. I think that is a delicious idea.
Outstanding. Tasty, even.
Indeed.
All right, so, 3 Squared for this week is your pick for your composer. And I like this. This is definitely a very interesting twist on the norm that we've been doing of zany categories. But what I like about this one is that people... I think that composers really can be more of an unsung hero, really, because... And I'm not talking about soundtrack, because... Soundtracks are neat and good, but that's really more about the pop culture style or what you would hear on the radio based on the movie. The composer does the score, and that, for me, really sets the tone of the movie and really allows you to get into the feel of it, to pick up the mood. And I think that our picks for this one have been exceptional. And without further ado, why don't you take it away, sir? What was your pick? Who was your pick for your favorite composer?
Danny Elfman is my pick. He actually started out whenever I was just... Well, I guess whenever I was born, really. I mean, that's when he was first started becoming well-known in the movie world. I love Danny Elfman. Not only because does he produce such awesome scores and soundtracks, but what he does with his music is something that is very different from what other composers do. And he, for each film, he makes his music one of the characters for that particular film. Within establishing the mood and helping to establish the scenery and whatnot, it takes on its own character. So the three films that I chose best embody his work as a composer and as a developer of a character within his score. These are the three films that I chose. The first film is actually like the third mainstream film that he made after Pee-wee and a couple others, I forget. But Beetlejuice. Not only a terrific Michael Keaton film and also directed by Tim Burton, but it entails gorgeous, creepy, harsh stringed instruments that whenever you hear it, you automatically think Beetlejuice. And this is the one score of his that really sets the precedent for Nightmare Before Christmas, even Mars Attacks, Sleepy Hollow, all of these famous gothic-type films. The style of music, its origins are from Beetlejuice itself. And the second film I chose is from 1997, and that is Good Will Hunting. And this film, the music is very mathematical. It's very piano-y and acoustic guitar-y, very scientific sounding. And it's great. It totally embodies the character of a science person, a mathematical person. If you are familiar with the film, Gus Van Sant's Good Will Hunting, then you should know what the film is about. I mean, math. It's all mathematical and math and algebraic equations and whatnot. And this film score itself is a algebraic equation if you listen to it. And then the third film is Big Fish from 2003. Yes, another Tim Burton film collaboration. Another gorgeous, beautiful movie itself. If you've seen the movie, then you know it's creepy, very storytelling, very epic, I suppose. It's an adventure film. It's a traveling film. A lot of creatures are being encountered. A lot of goofy, gorgeous satire and funniness and a great romance. So this score itself encompasses all these different genres of horror, mystery, fantasy, and romance. Just beautifully. You have the lush, swooning, beautiful violins and the full orchestrations that just automatically from the very beginning of the film just take you into the story. It takes you into the sea to meet the big fish and whatnot. So it's just very involving in itself, again, a character within the film. And that would be my three squared, sir.
Outstanding, outstanding. And my pick, I feel, is probably the only person who is on par with Danny Elfman. And I think simply due to the sheer length of the epic career could be considered arguably better than Danny Elfman. Because let's make one thing clear. Danny Elfman is no slouch in any way, shape, or form. But I have chosen John Williams.
Ah, yes.
And this is a guy who has literally had a career going just about six decades. Okay, this guy was born in February 1932, and he is a composer, he's a pianist, he's a conductor, and I guess just an all-around savant, almost. The man's genius is legendary. I mean, we're talking about a guy whose career has literally spanned the first season of Gilligan's Island in terms of scoring, all the way up to and through Star Wars, Jaws, Superman, Indiana Jones, E.T., Hook, Jurassic Park, Schindler's List, I mean, Home Alone, Harry Potter, for crying out loud. There is, like, literally no moviegoer alive today who has not heard some semblance of John Williams' music. Did the TV series Lost in Space as well. He's done the stupid theme for the NBC Nightly News, for crying out loud.
Do, 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 do.
Yeah.
Was that it?
Do, do, do. I think, yeah, that's it.
That's something.
And we do so give it the justice it deserves by our little rendition here. And so when you have someone, the problem becomes is that when you have someone literally this recognizable and this prolific, how do you pick movies that best give you examples of what this man is capable of without going to the, I don't want to say cliche, but to all the easy stuff? And I accepted this challenge, and I went with three movies that I think are very good movies in and of themselves, and in terms of genre-specific or perhaps audience-specific, especially in the case of the second one, but really give you an idea of his music through the ages, so to speak, because when this, you know, again, he was born in 32, he's 79 years old, and upon this man's passing, we are going to lose the 20th century's best, arguably best composer for movies and TV, absolutely. So, my choices were, from 1974, Towering Inferno, which is really one of the best disaster movies, I think, ever. And something, again, from what we were talking about before with Skyline, kind of something that was, Skyline kind of took a bit of its premise from this movie, which is really, really good. You should definitely check it out. We're talking about a movie that literally has about as many big names in it as you could possibly stand. Steve McQueen, Paul Newman, William Holden, Faye Dunaway, Fred Astaire, Susan Blakely, and the list goes on and on. This is a great, great flick, definitely worth watching. Should always, should definitely check it out. Now, for the younger fanfare and wanting to get into the idea of space and exploration, especially, was something that I thought was good for kids. It is definitely not a movie for adults, but I enjoyed this movie when I was a kid. Okay, do not think that this movie is good for adults. It's Space Camp. Did not do well in the box office. Did not do well in the box office at all. But I thought it was a great kids movie. Maybe they marketed it to the wrong people. I don't know. The biggest problem with this movie was that it came out 5 months after the Challenger accident. At any rate, I still think this movie's good. Directed by Henry Winer. It's got Leah Thompson in it, Tate Donovan, Tom Skerritt. Give it a check out. I think it's a pretty interesting flick. Last but not least is from 2005, Munich, which is directed by Steven Spielberg. Of course, it's Eric Bana and Daniel Craig. And probably the only movie that I have ever liked Eric Bana in. So
really?
Yeah, I am not an Eric Bana fan.
That's the only movie I like Daniel Craig in.
Well, see, it just goes to show everybody has a little taste somewhere.
And ironically, that is Spielberg's last great movie.
Well, there you go. But he's so not far. Done yet.
No,
you
true.
Know, we got
true.
War Horse coming up and Tintin's coming up. That he's involved with on both of those. So, and coincidentally, John Williams also involved in both of those. So, that's my pick. Those are the picks. Towering Inferno, Space Camp, and
Nice.
And I believe that is our three square.
That is indeed.
Woo!
Yay!
Alrighty. Well, cool beans. So, the three squared for next week. I think the three squared for next week, we're going to do your favorite actor or actress who you feel has a filmmaker's version of a messiah complex, okay? Someone who not only stars in the movie, but also has to, like, direct it, or direct it and wrote it and starred in it, or directed it and produced it, or produced it and star. You know, basically they starred in it, and then they also did something along the lines of directing and producing and writing, any combination, as long as they also starred in it. It would typically help if they also choose roles for them that are somehow mythical in their status, nearly. So, think Gladiator, okay, but only if Russell Crowe had directed it, kind of a thing. So, and I kind of already think I know who I'm going to pick, but we'll get there, we'll get there. So I think, we're looking at movies now. We have some movies.
We should, but however, I think I need to talk about a movie theater movie, one that's currently playing at the movie theaters. And that would be Contagion. It came out, and it looks like a lot of people have been receiving it pretty well. It's got pretty swell ratings. To me, this is the perfect movie to bridge the summer blockbusters with the fall, a little bit more what I call serious films, I guess. Serious entertaining films, there you go. More of the Hollywood or Hollywood take on Academy Award worthy films. And this film is good. It's a really, really good movie. Great performances, and it takes on the idea of a worldwide sickness, disease, pandemic very realistically. You have characters reacting in all different ways. It shows like the real aspects of shit going wrong when it should actually go wrong. And nothing is sugar-coated. And that's what I really like about these movies. And if you didn't already know, the film is helmed by Steve Soderbergh, who directed movies like Aaron Brockovich, the Oceans 11, 12, 13 movies. He did Che. He did Girlfriend Experience. He's just done a wide range of films. And I'm glad to see that he did something like this to add to his repertoire, I suppose. And one thing that really has gotten me about this film, a lot of people before they saw it kept comparing it to Outbreak. And I'm guessing it's because, and I know you did as well. Yeah, you would say, do we need another Outbreak?
Well, don't let that confuse the issue. I was just curious as to how it would stand up against a film like Outbreak, which had a similar tone.
Right, exactly. And a lot of people thought that at all, but the tone is completely different. Even in the trailer, to me, I thought, at least, the tone is different. A critic who didn't like Contagion said that it's a talkie. He was expecting it to be something exciting and something flashy. And this is definitely a movie where you have to just concentrate completely. You have to be devoted to the movie. The movie is only an hour and 40 minutes long. And I've watched it opening week, weekend, with a whole bunch of 20-something-year-olds on their phones, talking, being loud before the movie, being jerks, being assholes, kicking seats, being unruly and whatnot. But when the movie started, when you hear the first cough in the film to where all hell breaks loose, hardly anybody said a word. I mean, you could hear a pin drop whenever there was silence in the film. There's quite a bit of silence, and there's quite a bit of talking in the film. So, to me, at least, that just goes to show how much the movie can have impact on a variety of people, because it actually raises a topic that could even possibly happen. And another good thing about the film is that it's realistic. And, Matt, you told me before that you read something that
It was an interview I heard, and the movie is very, very realistic. They definitely did their homework and the research and the presentation in terms of plausibility, even down to like the green notebooks that the CDC people are using and everything. Those are the actual green notebooks that they use. And this is nothing, no spoiler here, but the virus that is basically, it goes from bat to pig to human, and that is a very plausible chain for that to happen. Really, the only thing that wasn't realistic was the was the time frame. The time frame for action taking place on the CDC side, when things start actually developing, it takes a month or two. Well, in the real world, it would be more like a year. So, definitely spot on. So it's not like Outbreak in that regard, in any way, shape, or form.
Yeah. So I encourage all of you to go see it, or at least if you're not big movie theater people, especially after you see this movie, you might think twice about going to a movie theater. Actually, probably even walking out your door, really. At least.
And again, remember, plausible, not likely to happen.
Exactly.
Bear that in mind when you watch this movie.
Exactly. All right, but yeah, in a nutshell, that's my little early review of Contagion.
Very cool, very cool. Hopefully I'll get a chance to see it and either confirm or deny your viewpoint. Not for you, just for me, about you. Let's talk movies. So, Hobo with a Shotgun was the movie we were both supposed to watch together. And basically, this is a movie with Rutger Hauer, and again, this is a film that pays the most ridiculous homage to every single late 70s, early 80s exploitation movie you can possibly think of, including, and not just exploitation, but also a little bit of horror as well. And basically, he plays a hobo who comes to a town called, I think it's called Hope Town is the supposed name, but basically it's all like the spray paint over the word hope with like hell or something.
So, fuck, like, they call it Fuck Town.
Well, that too. And so he's comes, you know, so he comes to the town and really he's just trying to make a fresh start for himself and start a lawn mowing business. You know, basically just wants to get a lawn mower and mow people's lawns, you know. And of course, the town he lands in, though, has to be the most evil, twisted, corrupt town ever in the history of evil, twisted, corrupt towns. Imagine, for those who have ever seen the Chainsaw Massacre, Texas Chainsaw Massacre, if the crazy-ass family that ran that little house and pretended to be the sheriff and stuff, but put it in an actual city, like, I don't know, a small city, like a mining town or something like that. So I mean, you know, and that's the crazy whacked out side of it.
And the movie itself is based in the 80s, even.
Yes, I was actually going to go with mid to late 70s, based on clothing.
Oh no,
cars.
Oh, no. No, that's 80s. That is definitely 80s.
Well, having grown up and watched that stuff when it really happened, I'm gonna go with late 70s. That's just me, because I kind of lived it. But I could be wrong. Maybe I was living something else at the time when you weren't alive yet? I don't know.
I don't know. I still say at early 80s. I'm gonna go with early 80s. But
But it doesn't matter. I mean, it is definitely easily within that time frame. We'll give it, shall we say, 77 to 83. You know, you want to give it somewhere in there?
Right, that's fine.
Okay. All right. Is that early enough 80s for you? At any rate, so he still just tries to keep his head down and just kind of do his own thing until he... And he degrades himself finally to the point where he gets himself taped or whatever, eating glass and stuff like that, and being stupid hobo or whatever, and makes his money to go buy his lawnmower. And then he goes to the pawn shop, and the pawn shop gets robbed. And he pulls, and so he sees a shotgun right on the wall mounted above the lawnmower, and pulls down the shotgun and starts laying waste. And there's Hobo with a Shotgun, decides to clean up the town. This hobo, like one of the newspaper headlines read, you know, hobo stops begging, demands change.
Yeah, stuff like that was funny. And the whole idea of Hobo with a Shotgun is to me, it's really, really good. And especially the idea of all this evil and craziness is going on in this town, but, you know, who cares about what's going, like, how they're getting away with it, you know? The suspension of, I guess, logic in that regards as well, that's totally the type of movie that they're playing homage to, how they were like in many, many ways. What would you rate it exactly?
I gave it 4 out of 5 stars on Netflix, for whatever that's worth. I thoroughly enjoyed the movie. It is not, by any stretch of the imagination, one of the best movies ever, which is what prevented it from being 5 stars, because I gave it 4 stars for really enjoying it for what it was. And it is a terrible, terrible, rip-off of every exploitation movie and slight and with nods to horror as well, ever. And I just really liked how they pulled it off. I think the only thing that could have made it perfect was if the blood they used was that acrylic paint-looking blood that they used back in the late 70s and early 80s for the cheaper movies. But they did use, you know, today's corn syrup blend of blood. And I loved it. I loved the music that was playing at the beginning and the credits rolling and how it looked when he came into town on the rail. And I loved how it just how outrageous that it was, and the story and how simple it was, and also how ridiculous it was, from including the bad guy who has the two sons, and one's just, they're both evil, but one's stupid and one's smart, and all the way also to the plague, which is supposedly these mythological bad guys, and this is kind of the nod to the horror aspect of it. These mythological people who supposedly have been living for hundreds of years with, like, plate armor and have a giant octopus or giant squid in their basement. And they have, like, all these pictures on the wall of all the people that they've killed, including, like, you know, Queen Elizabeth I, like, from the 1700s or whatever, Abraham Lincoln's on the wall, all these people that they're, like, supposedly responsible for killing, and they're, like, the demons incarnate. And they're the people that, they're the evil hit squad that gets called when the bad guys can't do it on their own.
All right, so I gave the movie 2 out of 5 stars because I didn't like it. Now, I mean, after thinking about it for a while, I will go and give it 2.5 out of 5 because I'm nice. Okay, so this is my little what I thought of the film. The film plays homage to many different genres, as what Matt was saying. And to me, that's what kills it. You have a revenge flick. You have an 80s or late 70s monster-type flick. A post-apocalyptic-type feel to it. You have mindless gore flick. Just an abundance of all this stuff. And the film has, many times, captures the essence of all these quite wonderfully. But it's fragments. But the in-your-face, over-the-top gore within the first 30 minutes of the movie made me completely immune for what was yet to come in the next 45 minutes or whatnot. The movie has a 67% fresh on the tomato meter, on Rotten Tomatoes, and obviously people really dig this film. They really like it, and I can see why they like it. And I'm a huge fan of these cult movies. Like, I grew up watching all this stuff, a lot of this stuff. So I can definitely appreciate what they're trying to go for. And in fact, for the movie Grindhouse that Tarantino and Rob Rodriguez made, this movie got made because they won a contest where they made a short film, which is really crappy. But it's well made because it was kind of like what this was, but with different actors. And they won the trailer contest for Grindhouse, and I guess after that they decided to make this movie. And to me, this is really like a salty mix of all these different genres. And you have, like, the beginning when he's riding on the train, which I love, and you had, like, the classic 70s orchestrational type music that goes really well. And eventually you'll move into, like, the really zombified late 70s, early 80s, kind of really corny, like, synthesized keyboard, like, pow, wow, 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 type of thing. And then by the end of the movie, whenever the plague people come along, you have the John Carpenter type, kind of like, I call it the smooth jazz synthesized keyboard, or the horror type, scary, whatever, films at that time. And I wanted them to stick with one and move on, because I was kind of getting into the beginning, and like I said, I'm putting the mindless gore and whatnot aside. But then by the time we got to the end with the plague people, I just thought that was, that to me, that was kind of a cop-out. I mean, I understand they were going for a homage to all this different stuff, but I think they should have totally just, you know, kept to one homage to a particular the particular style. It was just too many different types of style. And like I said before, it was also the insane gore at the beginning. To me, things can be done. You know, even the gore, even Planet Terror with Grindhouse, or even a lot of the zombie films from the 70s, like the movie Zombie that Matt and I are planning on seeing here in an older film in a couple weeks, made by an Italian horror filmmaker from the time. It was bloody as hell, but the movie still had story parts of it that are interesting. It had some humor, and the movie was so bad itself that it made up for the crazy, ridiculous gore, and it just kind of all fit together. With this one, it seemed like they were doing the gore just to do the gore. Just say, oh, it would be great to do this, blah, 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 and this, but it really didn't add anything to the film.
Well, see, there you go, though. But say, that's just it. As you say, you let the first 30 minutes or the first 10 minutes or whatever of gore numb you to everything else that, or make you immune or whatever to everything else that happened in the movie. And that's the whole point of that first 10, 15 minutes of gore is to immediately...
It's the first 30 minutes. It's not what made... I just got tired of it. I was.
But that's
ready
the
to
whole thing
it
is that it's that it... It still escalates. You're sitting there saying that it's you were tired of it or whatever, but or that you were numb to it or immune to it or however you want to say it. You're sitting there saying that it was gore for gore's sake, and it's not. That's the whole thing, is that you're wanting it to stick to one homage, but it can't. You cannot. That's the problem with the exploitation genre. It's the problem with the horror thriller kind of a genre, especially when it's done poorly, is that you can't carry it anymore. You can't carry it anymore. You can't do I Spit on Your Grave now. There's a reason why you can't do I Spit on Your Grave now. There's a reason why the Last House on the Left couldn't, when it was remade, still sucked. Because you can't do just one thing anymore. And that's why the story, as simple as it was, they used all those genres, and they poked fun at them, and they poked fun at themselves, and they used them in that order, like with what you said with the music and everything.
Yeah,
they used them in that order.
It doesn't go together. To me,
but that's just it. Is that it's a simple, coherent story of Hobo with a Shotgun.
Correct, but the film is playing a homage to those type of movies, to like the low budget exploitation. I understand that.
I think you're expecting too much.
I'm not expecting too much, Matt. It's just, it's kind to me, I think it kind of goes back to the whole, the movie The Black Death. You know, to where how, you know, for me, I enjoyed it from the entertainment value of, you know, I guess the story and really what I liked about it. And you didn't like it for your reasons. And with this, I kind of see, you know, you like it for, you know, the reasons that you said you liked it. And there are many features of this film that I really did enjoy. I mean, I thought whenever they introduced, or whenever, you know, they were showing the different types of exploitation film, or not showing, but it moved into the one, whenever it got settled in, before to me it would ruin itself, or screw itself over, I was enjoying it. Like, whenever I got used to the plague, you know, the demon people or whatnot, when they were trampling through the hospital, you know, shooting people and, you know, shooting them up, making them, you know, hang from the ceiling, I thought that was awesome. I wanted to see more cool stuff like that. I mean, instead of spending... I mean, it's low budget, obviously, but the budget that they had on certain things, they could have used it to expand and make... you know, go more into just the development of... You know, to make it more fun in the pacing, exciting to look at what the character will do next. Instead of just, like, killing within the first 30 minutes... There can be more of like a build-up to it, to where by the time it's over, it means something. I mean, this is what Wes Craven did with Last House on the Left. I mean, even in the commentary and documentary, he even talked about it, of the genre at the time. And of course, with even exploitation films, there are different even subgenres with that. It's just, you know, with anything else, you just kind of pick and choose what you like and you know you don't like. It's just, I felt that the characters themselves were there. I thought Rutger Howard did a tremendous tremendous job as the hobo with the shotgun. I thought it felt to me, especially the girl, a lot of it felt too modern for me. Actually, that might be the sole reason, really. To me, it just felt a little too modern. It didn't feel as authentic as it could have been.
Well, and there you go. So you feel that it wasn't authentic. I think the utilization of a drastically simple story told through the prism of continuing the changing of the different styles of exploitation genre stayed true to all of those particular genres and never stayed with one too long. And I thought it was great. And you obviously feel the opposite. So I don't think we're ever going to agree on it. So I think we should just go ahead and move to the next movie. All right. So moving on to the next movie was The Expendables. And that was the movie I had you watch. Now, again, I really like this movie, but again, because I accept this movie for what it is, which is simply just a throwaway popcorn action flick that does nothing but glorify all of the 80s action movies from which these guys, with the exception of Jet Li, were made famous.
So, out of 5 stars, I gave this one 2 stars. Didn't care for this one either. I had 2 throwback movies, and I didn't care for either of them. Mainly because I think there are just so many movies that have come out that were kind of doing the same type of thing that, to me, did such a better job. Like, with, you know, same with Hobo with a Shotgun. And Expendables, to me, was subpar, really. Even like, I thought Rambo, the new Rambo movie, was better than this movie. And I actually really thoroughly enjoyed it. And to me, this is by far not a throwback to 80s action films. I've seen probably all of them. I feel comfortable to say I've seen all of them. And to me, The Expendables lacks the tension, the good humor, and the context. The computerized violence and the gore completely overshadows the little nostalgia that the film evokes. And at times it does evoke that fun, buddy sense of action and adventure and whatnot. There are more scenes of Stallone crying or being somber than there are chuckles, in my opinion. Statham and Stallone are the only two performers worth noting positively. I mean, I think Statham, whenever he was trying to be funny, he kind of was funny and charming and whatnot. And that whole little kind of spit thing, that spat he has with Mickey Rourke's character with the throwing the knives, I thought that was kind of interesting. And, you know, it just everybody had their neck. Even Stallone, you know, being as at his age, he still pulls off the macho-ness and hero dude, where it's like, dude, if I was in a fight or if I was going into war, I would be behind you, sir, anytime. And all the other Expendables, to me, lacked personality. Even Jet Li just lacked personality. The bad guy is even generic at best. If this is, you know, I just think people would have a better time checking out, you know, First Blood, the original First Blood.
Okay, I want an example of a movie that does what Expendables does in terms of, you know, just completely overdoing the 80s style of a movie. Because, you know, you mentioned Jason Statham, who's famous for Crank and Crank 2 High Voltage. Okay, those were believable movies. And, you know, you're talking about the violence, the over-digitalized violence of Expendables with the same amount of violence, if not more, done so in the latest Rambo movie.
Yeah.
So I would like to, but
I enjoy
celebrate it in Rambo, you disparage it in Expendables.
Yes,
so I would like a movie that you think is better.
Matt, people don't always have to agree with you.
I know, but I'm wanting to know. You said there are movies that have done it already and done it better.
Yes,
give me
Rambo,
a movie.
The latest Rambo movie.
But that's not the same kind of movie.
It's not the same kind of movie. That's what I mean. It's better than that. To me, it works out. It works. I enjoyed it. It has its corniness that, you know, Rambo 2 and Rambo 3 had. It has the corniness that, you know, corniness that just a lot of Arnold Schwarzenegger movies from the 80s, like Commando, I guess. You know, just movies like that, you know, Rambo still kind of had to where, you know, it's a Stallone movie. You're going to have cool, kind of cool action. And a lot of it was stunts, and it's been a little while since I saw when it first came out on I watched it on a DVD or I rented it, And I remember just being completely into it for the most part. You know, I liked it. This one, I just didn't find it funny whenever they're trying to have the humor. I mean, I could tell when they're trying to be like the old, you know, kind of like the Lethal Weapon humor that Mel Gibson and Danny Glover had, where they would just crack these little jokes and, you know, I'd be like, oh, they're best pals. I didn't get that feeling with all these people. I didn't get the feeling that Statham and Sylvester Stallone were good old buds and they knew each other for a while. Same thing with Mickey Rourke. Even with the thing with Bruce Willis and Arnold Schwarzenegger, a lot of this stuff felt like it was pushed onto the audience for the sake of it being a big name movie, you know, tipping its hat to films or action films of the 80s. And that's it. I mean, people like it. You know, that's cool. I mean, if you like it, then good.
All right. So, Buried then. Yeah, I hated it. So.
Bullshit. You told me you didn't hate it. You said you're really into it until the end.
Yeah, I was trying to not spoil it. So, we'll try this again. Okay, Buried. Do not listen to the following statements beyond what I'm saying now if you don't want any spoilers about this movie. This is one of those movies that I simultaneously loved and hated at the same time. And I hate it because he dies. I'm not going to spend 90 minutes in a box with somebody going through all the gamut of emotions and trying to help and you know, or not help, but, you know, be there with someone like that just to be let down at the end like that. That was some bullshit right there. And essentially the movie is Ryan Reynolds plays a truck driver. He's a contracted truck driver in Iraq who is kidnapped by Iraqis and buried in a box. And they're trying to hold him for ransom, basically. So, and he's left with a lighter, a flask with some alcohol in it, some medication that he needs, two glow sticks, a pen, a pencil, and a cell phone. That's it. So he has to try and figure out how he's going to, you know, get out and stay alive. And you spend 90 minutes in a box with this man. So, from that end of it, from that aspect of it, it's really, really good. And I did like the writing, and the writing definitely drives the story. But by the end of it, you can kind of see where it's going. And, like, he gets fired, which I thought was, you know, even though I love Stephen Tobolowsky, I was like, really? Come on now. And then he dies. You go through this whole thing and he dies. And I was mad. I think somebody got a text message at like 3 o'clock in the morning going, I fucking hate you. So, you know, that's where it was. That's how I feel about the movie.
But it... All right.
And I literally gave that movie one star. Because I was that mad. I have never... Never in my life been angry at a movie. I was angry at that movie.
I don't think that's fair.
And and what did I just sit through? I just sat through you trashing Expendables. So you're
you
gonna
did,
sit
but
through.
You,
so
hey,
you're
you
gonna sit
you.
Through.
I
you're
can
gonna sit
as
there.
Well.
Hey, well, you know, Tim, we can have different opinions. We don't always have to agree.
I know, Mom, but I can.
All right.
You.
Well, golly gee willikers, Beeve. Let's go get Mikey. He'll eat anything. So.
Face.
No, seriously, it's because he dies. If he had lived, I'd have loved it. And it's just that simple.
Yeah. Well, and one thing that I've kind of learned from watching the Twilight Zone episodes, which we will get to, is that movies are usually not about the ending, especially thrillers. It could be about the ending, but it shouldn't all be about the
ending.
It
is always about the ending.
But it's about the journey. I mean, through the movie, I mean, to me, the movie has an impact. The movie had an impact. I mean, there are not many movies where, there are. Like, you can watch movies where people survive, and it's terrific. But honestly, the movie would not have the same impact as it did if he lived, to me.
Let's see here. Twilight Zone.
Yes.
Judgment Night.
Yeah, This one, it was entertaining. You know, kind of like what we talked about before. We got to quit looking for that darn twist ending here.
Yeah, I think we're trying. I think, yeah. We talked about when we were doing a show prep. We definitely talked about this with. I think you and I specifically are trying too hard. I think we're not letting the show happen. We're looking for it instead of just letting it happen.
Yeah, and with doing that, I enjoyed the mood, the tone, I guess, of the episode. Because, well, all of them kind of have a neat little tone to it. But then it kind of gets corny there at the end, where it turns out he's actually what, you know, you think he's going to be already.
Well, it's funny, though, because I like... This is... Okay, Tim and I have definitely had our fair exchanges on air, for, I guess, if we want to use that term while we're recording, and also behind the scenes, in terms of politics and religion and stuff like that. And this is one of those times where I think most people who follow Tim's thinking versus people who follow my thinking would be surprised at what I'm about to say. This is the stupidest instance of religion I have ever seen in my life. Okay. Basically, we have a guy. And he's on a ship in 1942, and he only knows his name, and he only knows where he was born, and he seems to know a lot about U-boats, but he doesn't know why. And he's on this boat, and he just knows that something terrible is going to happen. And it's 1942, and basically, he thinks that a U-boat's going to attack it. And spoiler alert. It turns out he's the captain on the U-boat, and what's happening is he's going through his own personal hell, and he has to relive killing all these people, these men, these women, this one little girl on this boat that was traveling in a convoy across the Atlantic during World War II that gets sunk. And the thing is that once the sinking of the boat happens, they go back to the U-boat where now you see him, you know, as his real self, and a crewman comes in.
With great English, or
yes, with amazing English for his supposedly being German, and says, you know, he feels bad and he thinks that, you know, there's going to be a special hell reserved for people like us where we have to relive all of our terrible sins. Okay, Nazis in World War II, there was no church. There was no religion. There was no talking about religion. There would have been no crewman that would have gone to their captain and said anything remotely like that. At all, ever. I'm sorry. Not without going, and when I'm done with this speech, if you could drop me over by the gas chamber, that would be great, because that's what would have happened to them.
I feel like I wanted to go to the gas chamber after that. It was...
I'm sorry. This was the worst instance of inserting religion into something. I thought, you know... Unless the twist was that after all of their non-religious beliefs that they did end up in it. I don't know. I may be reading it too much into it, but poor writing on that angle. Yeah. But I think going forward, Tim, I think you have it right. We're trying too hard. We're just going to have to... For when the sky was opened... That doesn't have a religious connotation. I don't know what. yeah, we'll have to check that one out for next week.
Yeah, and is that it? Other than talking about our favorite, but before we say what movies we're gonna watch,
you have a recommendation.
Oh, I do have a film, a classic film recommendation.
That's right, and it squeaked in at 25 years too.
It is. It squeaked in like the pucker. Oh, I'm not gonna say that. But this was on Turner Classic Movies. It's actually also on Netflix Instant Quay as well. It's called A View.
Instant Quay.
Instant Quay. That's, you know, that's whenever I first got Netflix, I was like, why the fuck is it Quay? I mean, like, is this Spanish or something? Like, and the girlfriend at the time was like, Tim, it's Q. I'm like, oh, thank you. A Room with a View. It's with Helena Bonham Carter. Young Helena Bonham Carter, as well as Daniel Day-Lewis and Maggie Smith, and a whole list of other great British actors. And it's a gorgeous film. It's a, to me, it's a perfect film. And it's definitely a delight and fun to watch. I had myself a ball. And it's, I believe it won quite a few Academy Awards. It was nominated for 9 or 10. Quite a few. But it's great. So, A View, A Room with a View. And good news, next month is October, so that means Halloween-y, scary...
Yes, scary movies.
Yes. This month, you guys get to look forward to Matt and I going to River Oaks Theater here in Houston. Classic film place to go see great films at midnight, where this month they'll be... this month they'll be showing films like A Nightmare Before Christmas, the classic Italian film, or made by the classic Italian horror director. It's called A Zombie. Mentioned that earlier, and then we got a couple other movies that are coming out that if Zach and I don't see together, I will at least go check it out, and we'll let you know how that goes.
And you'll have to let me know what Zach thinks when you take him.
Zach kind of sounds like Matt, but I think Zach is living in the view from the room.
Ah, I see. I see.
The movies that we'll be watching, I recommended to Matt to watch the classic film from 1939. It is called White Zombie.
Yes, and definitely looks very interesting, so I'm looking forward to seeing that. Now, this movie, I'm going to be honest with you here because, you know, in the interest of full disclosure, Tim had kind of expressed interest in seeing this movie, And I was like, well, it's really not that great. It's just an okay movie. And he was like, well, I still think I want to see it. So I was like, okay, well, then I'm officially giving off the okay, signing off on the recommendation for The Toxic Adventure, which for me is really more of a comedy than a horror movie, but it does kind of fit in the horror aspect a little bit because, it, you know, it's a toxic Avenger, so it's gross. So I'll be interested to see what you have to say about that. And then the movie we're both supposed to watch is a movie called Henry, Portrait of a Serial Killer.
Yes, which will probably be the classiest film we will watch out of that entire segment of movies.
Indeed. But I will say this, I'm definitely looking forward to going and checking out all the movies we're supposed to watch this month, because we're doing Zombie, we're doing Nightmare Before Christmas, I think, and we're doing Human Centipede, full sequence.
Shit, I still have to see the first one. I haven't seen the first one yet.
At any rate, yeah, so we'll get to, what was the other movie? There was like four movies there, because I was going to have to be there for like 3 weeks in a row, it seemed like.
Because
there was like the 14th and the 15th and then like the 20th and something else. It doesn't matter. We'll get it. The point is, we're going to be going to supporting a local independent film theater.
Yes, and I am sure that all you people in these big, booming metropolis cities, you have one. I know California, Los Angeles has a few. Quentin Tarantino has opened up a few. Chicago has them. New York has them. They're all over the place. In Ohio.
Oh, yeah. And then even if you're not into art films or art house films or indie films, a lot of times these theaters will run like Mel Brooks marathons and stuff like that, and they'll do theme things like it's October, so they're going to be doing Rocky Horror Picture Show.
Well, they actually do that once a month as well.
There you go. So yeah. So there's always reasons to go check these things out. So yeah. Please go. And a lot of times there are some chains of them, but a lot of times you are supporting small business and local business, and you're also keeping a small part of movie history alive every time you go to one of those theaters. So,
exactly, yeah, and like I saw Quadrophenia the other night, and I've seen Maltese Falcon and all of these greats. So, yeah, like you said, you support the community, especially. I think it's good to preserve all these great classic theaters.
Amen. So, that being said, I think we're done. let's do the finale, shall we? The music that you hear is always provided to us by our wonderful music partners, Cries of Solace. You can catch them at both MySpace.com and Facebook.com/CriesofSolace. You can catch us at our website, SLScast.com. You can always contact us via email by going to your email and sending us an email at theslscast@gmail.com. You can follow us on Twitter at theslscast, and of course you can go to iTunes and subscribe there, comment there, comment on our website. We would love to hear from you, and please don't hold back. Tell us when you agree with one of us, with both of us, with neither of us, and you know, we want to hear everything, good and bad. So get on with it. Let us know, and we will catch you guys on the flip side.
Adios.
Thanks again for listening to the SLS Cast with your hosts, Matt and Tim. Remember that you can find us at slscast.com, at the SLS Cast for Twitter, also on Facebook, and you can always subscribe on iTunes. Thanks again for listening.